Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Your host, Andrew Donaldson. This is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Okay, one of my favorite people just to talk to in general, but he's also great on a lot of really intricate things because he thinks things through. Our good friend Dennis Saunders back on the program. He's a writer, he's a commentator, he does other things. For the purposes of this conversation, though, he lives in Minnesota. He pastors in St. Paul. He knows all kinds of things about up there. But he was made in Flint, Michigan. He's what my Aunt June would have called a real nice young man from a good union family. So we're going to talk some Rust Belt politics with him. How are you, sir? Great to see you again.
I'm doing okay. Good to talk to you. It has been a while.
We've talked about this before in the aggregate, but just to focus on it, you grew up in Michigan. You were at a, you know, UAW household, auto workers, union home, that kind of an environment growing up, and now you're of the age where you've seen that change, the Rust Belt. We know electorally, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio is not really a battleground anymore. It's gone pretty red, but there's parts of it that still fit into this. You've seen it change. You've seen it go, and you've wrote about this extensively. You've seen it go from automaking and Sears to Amazon and a service-based economy that's had to recover from, let's just call it what it is, some industrial blight, really, if you want to put it that way. When you hear the term Rust Belt politics or Upper Midwest politics or swing state politics, we're going to hear that nonstop from now till November. What does it mean for you? Because that is you. That is your background. That's what you grew up. That's what you live now. How's it hit you?
Well, I think the way that it hits me is that it's about people who kind of have it rough going. They live in communities that may have once had a thriving industry, whether it's autos or some type of usually manufacturing, that's not the case anymore. And as you said, they are now, it's more of a service economy, and they're trying to do what they can to get by. And I think they are looking for candidates that will listen to them. I think one of the big mistakes, if we go back in time to 2016 with Hillary Clinton, is that she really did not pay attention to those Rust Belt states. And I think it gave the impression that the Democrats just didn't care, which is why I think Donald Trump was able to win all of those states, because she just never invested in them. And really, until maybe it was almost too late, I think Wisconsin, she didn't even visit at all. And I think these people who live in those states want someone that's just going to listen to them and not necessarily tell them to either A, get a job or to move someplace or that it's your fault or something to that extent, but that you're listening and you're caring about them and trying to offer solutions that will help them.
It's funny you bring it up that way because Hillary's campaign, she had the incident in West Virginia with the coal miners where mm-hmm. she just said, we're going to put all the coal miners out of business. Well, that didn't, now to her credit, she showed up in the coal fields and took the brunt of that in person. So credit to that. But she wrote an entire chapter of her book on that, on just that one incident in the What Happened book, a whole chapter just on that. She's not the only one. Al Gore goes to West Virginia. The state flips for the first time in 100 years. Democrat. Florida doesn't happen. Al Gore's president. Hillary to Wisconsin. You can go through history. There's lots and lots of example. You could argue Trump in 2020 didn't shore up a couple places he should have, especially Georgia, where he just yep. totally went to bed. And then in the runoffs, it made it even worse when he basically told people not to vote and they lost both Senate seats. That quote, you know, the history is replete with that. So as you're watching these two campaigns, Trump's on his third campaign. Obviously, Kamala Harris is on her first national campaign other than her primary campaign. What do you look for to see whether, like, that listening to thing is kind of a ethereal thing? Well, we want to be listened to. Well, they can't actually do a whole lot about it. So what does that listening to for these campaigns really mean, do you think?
I think what it's going to mean is, how are you going to make it more possible to really look at, I think it's John Halperin in the Liberal Patriot Substack has said, really focus on things like place-based aid that will kind of deal with the rising inequality that you might see in those communities. I think, you know, obviously it's going to have some policy things. Maybe that means focusing on some type of industrial policy. I don't think it has to be a super heavy-handed. I don't think it should be something heavy-handed, but it has to be some idea of how are we going to help revive these communities, helping them in some way of either through active retraining that people like Glenn Hubbard have suggested. It's basically, these are the type of policies. But I think, and because everyone's saying it these days, everything is based on vibes, which I really hate talking about, but it's there. People also have to feel that you care. Now, the interesting thing, I think, is that I would say this election season has been kind of split in two. I would say, and the turning point was the RNC, the Republican National Convention. I would say going up until that point, the advantage would have been Trump, that people felt that Trump had more, cared more. I don't think he does, but I think that that was how people felt. I think that that has changed after Joe Biden dropping out and Kamala Harris taking his place, that momentum has changed and that people feel a lot different about that. So I think the vibes obviously have something to do with that. But then once you have those vibes, then you have to also focus on the policies. And what are the policies that will make a difference? What are the policies that tell people that you're listening to them and that you care? I think Harris visiting the states that she has signaled that to a point. Whereas I think now Trump, after the RNC, is really kind of distracted and focusing on everything else but what's been going on in especially those Rust Belt states.
Yeah, Dennis Saunders, you bring up a point that I think is interesting, whether it's, you know, manufacturing jobs in the Midwest, upper Midwest, the Rust Belt, coal mining in West Virginia. My thing when we talk about things like this, like, I think the people are way ahead of the politicians and the news coverage on this. Yeah. They know manufacturing's not coming back mm-hmm. the way it was. You know, Youngstown Sheet and Tube employing 20,000 people, that's gone. That's not coming back.
Yeah.
You know, Detroit and the cities surrounding it, like Flint, where you grew up, where just, you know, every factory had 5,000 working people in it. That's gone. Steel mills are not open hearth anymore. They're mostly people sitting in front of computers managing the machines, right? They're pristine. You know, people, the manufacturing rhetorics from politicians, Biden's really guilty of this, but he's from the last generation, so I don't even blame him because he's saying what he's been saying for 50 years. I think the manufacturing talking point of we're bringing back manufacturing, I think the people are smarter than the politicians of understanding. It's like, okay, bringing back manufacturing doesn't mean bringing back massive amounts of jobs. Now, obviously, a big manufacturing facility will have, and that's this is what really killed the auto industry. It wasn't just losing the GM plant. It wasn't losing Lordstown and Youngstown. It wasn't losing, you know, Buick and Flint or whatever the Flint plant was. It was all the suppliers that go into that plant. Mm-hmm. It was all the restaurants. It was all that. Mm-hmm. It's the whole ecosystem of manufacturing is gone. And you can't replicate that. Do you feel that in the Rust Belt where you live, like Minnesota, Detroit, places like this, they know it's not going back to that. So does the rhetoric need to change when they say manufacturing jobs to more service-based jobs or more tech jobs or manufacturing jobs, but honest about them, like they're going to be 50 to 100 jobs, not 500 to 1,000 jobs? That rhetoric needs to change. I think the people are ready for it to change. I don't think the politicians are ready for it to change.
Well, yeah, and I think, like I said, I mentioned his name earlier, and I'll mention it again, is Glenn Hubbard. He was an economic advisor under George W. Bush. And I think he wrote an interesting book, I believe it was called The Wall and the Bridge. And he is someone that I think would be considered a traditional kind of quote-unquote Reaganite. So he's not someone that's out here talking about that we're going to bring manufacturing back to what it used to be or talking about tariffs or anything. But he does think that there are things that can be done in these communities and there are things that have to be done. And he kind of likens, goes back to things that happened, especially around the Civil War with Abraham Lincoln and land grant colleges and things to that extent. And I think that's really what needs to be done, is focusing on retraining, retooling. Maybe it's not going to be the manufacturing plant that has, as you said, thousands of people working on it, maybe hundreds, but it does mean trying to, you know, make and create a populace that is ready for that, and to retool those places. It's easy to try to say that you're going to, you know, bring back things to the way that they were, say, in 1974 or something, when we all know that's not going to happen. But I think the question that people in those in Rust Belt states are wanting to hear, or the answer that they want to hear is to their question of what next? Because I think for a lot of them and a lot of what the politicians haven't been doing is really answering, either they haven't answered that question and just kind of ignored it, or they try to talk about trying to revive a past that isn't coming. But we have to provide an answer of some type. And the problem is that I think we've done a bad job, politicians have done a bad job in providing a good answer. And a good answer means coming up with some ideas of how to help these communities and not just give them up for dead, not just tell people that they need to move to other places, but actually really finding out what is it that can be done and how do we do something that's specific to those regions that can help them.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to countrymd.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's countrymd.com/energy. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, Dennis Saunders joining us. You just mentioned Reaganite economics. We cover economics on this program a lot because one is I'm not an expert on it, but I understand it. It has a, you know, duplicative effect on everything else in politics and culture. So I bring on economists all the time, mutual friends of ours. One of the things with economics I've noticed in talking about it and feedback from doing the programs and my writing and just talking to the economists off air, just the conversation, because I'm asking questions because I don't know. I want to learn. We talked about manufacturing rhetoric being, I think our economic rhetoric's off a little bit too, because we're, you know, conservative no longer means small government. Trump is a big government. I don't think he's a conservative at all, but whatever conservatism that supports him, they spend a lot of government money. They spend a lot of government money. Big government spending is in even across, you know, the board, except for some very few holdouts like me who still worry about things like national debt. The thing about that is if you're going to spend government money, prevention is always cheaper than cures. Mm-hmm. And I think places like the Rust Belt, places like Appalachia, places like parts out west where they're having, you know, real changes because of things like the water crises and migration and people flooding into the Sun Belt, these sorts of, those are all political issues with policy problems underneath them, but they're all economic problems. And I think the economic conversation hasn't caught up to it. And what I mean by that is, whether it's the Rust Belt, Appalachian, the Sun Belt exploding while the Northeast, you know, bleeds people, this sort of stuff. When we talk about economic rhetoric, we don't talk enough about, hey, this is the Rust Belt, but there are places that have done investment. Pittsburgh is becoming a tech hub. the Lehigh Valley, which, you know, that's Bethlehem Steel, the carcass of the plant is still there, and they do a lot of concerts in front of it now. It's becoming a tech hub. There's places all throughout, places in Minnesota have become, you know, very popular for people that are doing remote work, things like this, because they want the outdoor lifestyle. This is part of the economy we don't talk about. This is part of that rhetoric that hasn't caught up of, there's these individual places that you can talk about where they're having success, but it does cost money, government money and private investment money. So I think even the term Rust Belt anymore, we just start losing that, hey, economically, you got to spend money to make money. That includes government investment. And you lose these little points of light because it's like, well, the Rust Belt, it's all dying. Well, no, it's not all dying. Downtown Cleveland's having a renaissance right now. You know, parts of Detroit have really started to turn the corner in the last 5 to 10 years, whereas 15 years ago when I flew in there and you look down, there's just big splotches of green where everything's just disappeared, right? How do we change that conversation from somebody, you know, this is who you are, this is where you're from. How do you talk about that in a productive way of like, yes, this part of, look, this is an age-old argument. This part of town's bad, this part of town's good. How do we even that up a little bit? But now we're talking about it regionally. We're talking about it demographically. How do we talk about that better?
Part of it is we have to really start telling those stories. Those, and I think that they are green shoots. They're not going to be the some type of massive turnaround that brought everything back to, you know, I think you talked a little bit about the Lehigh Valley and Youngstown, and I think I remember the story about in 1977 about the closure of the steel mills in that area and how that basically cascaded everything downward. You're not going to go back to pre-1977. And I think sometimes politicians, but even I think the general public want some kind of massive story where everything is back to what it was. But there are changes happening. But I think we just need to try to tell those stories more. Going back to the book by Glenn Hubbard, is that he does do that. He tells stories about what's happening in Youngstown and other places where there are things that are happening. Even in Flint, the downtown, I mean, years ago, it was not a place you really wanted to go. And I think it has become more of a destination. Partially because they, you know, did things like they brought the farmers market downtown, where it had kind of been at the edge of downtown. They now have it right in the center that has brought people into the city. There are other things like that happening, but it's, I think we just need more people telling those stories and maybe telling them in, this is kind of where I think the media needs to be a part of it, is telling those stories in the media. Doing Substacks or something where they're talking about, here's what's happening in Youngstown, here's what's happened in Pittsburgh, because I think people need to hear those stories. And I think if people hear those stories, then that might get to both the government and private industry to say, well, we need to invest in these communities, or that maybe we need to invest in our community. And here's what, if you know, they did this, maybe we can do that, try this instead. But it's really, we need people telling those stories. And again, I think this is really one of those places where the media needs to do that. We're good at telling negative stories, but we also need to tell stories of hope in a way. Not necessarily stories that have all a happy ending, but stories of people trying new things and trying different things in these regions. Because I think we just don't know those stories and people need to hear them.
Yeah, Dennis Saunders joining us. I like the idea of telling stories. Part of the problem here when you're talking about the Rust Belt politics that we're going to get beat over the head with for the next couple of months is, I think one thing the news media and commentators, and I'm a talking head sometimes too, so you can blame me for this as well. We don't do a real good job when we're doing electoral analysis of explaining that, okay, the poll numbers are one thing. Everybody's like, well, the polls are off, the polls are this and that. Well, because the polls are reflective of an electorate, and to win an election, you have to have an electoral coalition. And we don't do a good job about talking about the electoral coalition. But one of the defining features of the upper Midwest, the Rust Belt, whatever term we're going to use, is that changing electorate coalition. That's why you have these swing states, because they go back and forth. That's why you can have people that, you know, you have a red state with a blue governor, or you have the opposite. You have a blue state with a red governor. The electoral coalitions are how you win elections. If we're looking at the numbers of what's going on right now in those swing states, Michigan, Wisconsin, they're getting close again. But underneath it, what's really happening on the numbers is Trump's not actually moving. Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, has just, she's put back together the Democratic coalition that had fractured over the last 2-3 months under Joe Biden, under the concerns, and then it completely fell apart after the debate. She's put that back together, and now we're back to basically an even race in these races. That's polling wise and electorally wise what has happened. I want to go back to your experience, though. You grew up under the old electoral coalition, union workers, that sort of thing, blue-collar Democrats. That's not the Democratic coalition in the upper Midwest anymore. It's not the blue-collar workers. A lot of them went Trump-wise. Talk about what the new electoral coalition is, because we talk about the polls and the culture war and the horse race, and we don't spend enough time about talking about what the actual coalition in a Minnesota, in a Milwaukee, in a Cleveland, in a, you know, Detroit and Flint and these places in Michigan that are going to be contested, not Detroit, but the outer parts of Detroit will be heavily contested. What's the new coalition for Democrats that Kamala Harris is trying to put together actually look like on the ground from somebody that's from the Midwest?
I think what the coalition that she's trying to put together is looking somewhat, that I would not say exactly, like the Obama coalition of 2008. It's going to include, I would say, upscale white voters. It will include people of color. The one group that, well, I should also add kind of LGBTQ voters, but the one group that is going to be lacking, or at least could be lacking, would be working class voters. And that was actually an important part of the Obama coalition. And that actually made kind of a difference, and actually in some ways allowed him to win not once but twice. And I think that is the concern going forward, is can she win enough working class voters? I'm not certain, maybe, and because that coalition has been steadily moving towards the Republican column, and sometimes Democrats have not done a good job of saying that this is an important part of the coalition. In fact, sometimes they have said, we don't need that cohort to win. So, I mean, I think that is a real concern, is can she actually get enough working class voters to vote to pull the lever for the Democrats? I don't know. I think that personally, that might have been more the case with Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, because I think when he ran in 2022 in Pennsylvania, he was able to win in a state that I think tends to lean more Republican, and was able to win with more working class votes. With Tim Walz as her running mate, I'm not so sure. Maybe he can. I don't want to say it's impossible. There are some indications it could work. So I don't want to totally rule them out. I just don't know if that's a, I think, a key important coalition, part of the coalition that she needs, whether this pick was going to, I don't know if this pick was the right one to help get that yet. I guess we'll see in the coming weeks and months.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion, or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Families agents. Life's better when you're under American Families roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, we'll get to Tim Walz in just a second. Dennis Saunders joining us. Part of that coalition, though, is circumstance dependent. You just brought it up with Barack Obama. He might have beat John McCain anyway. He was probably leading in that race. But then the economic crisis of 2008 hit right in the fall of that, to the point that McCain made a big show of going back to the Senate to work on that and not campaigning for a few weeks, which, you know, hindsight's 2020, probably not a great idea. When you have what we now understand to be a generational kind of movement going on. Obama may have won it anyway, but that was a factor. It was undoubtedly a factor. The economy is going to be a factor in this race. Right now, it's trending, despite that little panic a week or so ago that was mostly online panic and people needed to calm down a little bit. There's some good economic indicators. If the economy gets better, that's one of those things that drives working class voters. We already talked about a vibe election. You know, I hate the term vibe, but it does explain it better than anything else we got. So until somebody comes up with a better term, let's use it. If the economic news is good, working class voters, economic news will greatly affect how they swing, especially people that maybe, you know, the hold their nose and vote for Trump crowd. You know, that, you know, they like the cultural stuff, but maybe they don't like the personality, or they like, you know, they did well during his presidency and they don't, you know, whatever the case may be. Let's go to that side of it, though, because the circumstance is Kamala Harris is not running in a vacuum. She's running against Donald Trump. Just being not Donald Trump isn't going to get her over the hump to win this election, especially the way the Electoral College plays out. What is Trump's message and is it hitting? Because I think the key to Trump is really going to be, does the cultural stuff and some, because he's not a policy heavy president. Sorry, he's not. He's a vibe president. Is that going to override being in year nine of people that are just frankly getting Trump fatigue and maybe they just want to do something different? How is that playing in places like the Midwest? Because I don't think the national media has caught the part of this where there's just a fatigue with Trump, even among Trump supporters. How much of the old playbook of they're socialists, they're da-da-da-da-da is going to override that, or is it just going to be Trump fatigue going to drag this ticket down the couple of points they need for Kamala Harris to win? I think that's the story in the Midwest and in these swing states that's not being covered.
I think it is, too. I think, you know, this is year nine of Trump and all the chaos, all the drama, and I think people are tired. And I think one of the things I think was interesting during when Biden was still in the race, I think everyone was talking about, and even I was talking about, how kind of disciplined Trump was. And maybe that's true, but I'm beginning to wonder if partially what that was is that everyone was focused on Biden and his issues and not focused on Trump and his issues. And now that Biden has been kind of taken away, now everyone can kind of see what Trump is doing. And people are just kind of, it's like, well, it's the same old, and they're just kind of tired of it and tired of every kind of weirdness story that comes out. And I know I used the word weird, but all of that kind of thing of just over and over and over again of hearing kind of these things that are not true and talking about trash, talking about the other candidate, and you know worried about things about, you know, the size of the crowds and all of that. People are, I think, are kind of getting tired of that. And one of the things that may doom Trump is not necessarily fears about the end of democracy or things like that, but just people are tired, and he is a kind of a candidate that just, you know, he drained so much energy from us that people just don't want to hear it anymore, and are kind of, they're over it.
Yeah, I wonder too. You brought it up. I don't even know how to really quantify this into a nice tight little soundbite, but there's something with Trump. The Trump supporter, let me put it in a football term, because we're football guys. You're a good Midwestern person. You like your football. In football terms, you talk about a quarterback being comfortable. Well, anybody can play quarterback when they're comfortable. When they're getting sacked every other play, then you find out whether they're any good or not, because, you know, they're under stress, right? I think what's happened with Trump in the last couple of weeks is he was very comfortable. They had their groove. They were clearly winning. He knew how to attack Biden because he'd been doing it for basically 5 years straight now. He was comfortable. He was hitting all his marks. He could appear to be, by his standards, I know it's a sliding scale, by his standards, was very disciplined during the debate. If he would have attacked Biden hard and heavy when Biden was flailing, that probably would have played a little different, but he was smart enough to just stay out of the way, didn't really attack Biden, just let Biden stand on his own, and we have what we have. He was very comfortable. He's uncomfortable right now. The campaign's uncomfortable. The reporting from the Age are like, we're telling him to do one thing. He's, you know, we're back to grievous mongering nonsense. I see a candidate that is uncomfortable, and instead of going to the comfort zone of his base and doing that, I see him flailing a little bit, like he doesn't exactly know how to attack this new thing. I don't know if it's because they were just in a groove and they didn't want to change midstream or whatever the case is. Does that metaphor work a little bit? Like, I think he's just uncomfortable right now and hasn't settled back in. I still think the Kamala Harris campaign needs to play like they're behind right now, because I think they're still behind. I think Trump's still the favorite to win this thing. But the pathway for her to win is much better than Biden's. And I think scares too much of a term, but it's made Trump very uncomfortable. It's thrown him off his game, and he hasn't really dialed in how to react to it. Is that a fair way to put it, you think?
I think so. He didn't prepare. He didn't prepare for the possibility that the Democrats actually might get their act together and force Biden out. He was confident that they wouldn't do that. And that's really, I think he planned his whole campaign on the fact that that Biden wouldn't leave, and that he would just have to be able to kind of coast to a second term. And so he never planned that things would change. And he now, I think someone has said somewhere, he's in a phase where he's trying to throw spaghetti at a wall to see what sticks. He just doesn't know how to handle this at all, because he just doesn't, he just didn't prepare for this to happen, which is not surprising, because he doesn't seem to be the type of person that plans on stuff. He just kind of goes with his gut. But he had banked on having Biden as his adversary, and he ended up not having that. And so he doesn't know how to deal with Harris at all.
I think he's going to fall into something too, is in his mind, I think he's going to try to run back 2016 when he beat Hillary Clinton, because obviously, you know, female candidate, all that stuff. He's not the candidate from 2016, and Kamala Harris has some real electoral weaknesses. She has some real problems. Nobody's heard her speak yet. I know us political folks have. The country hasn't heard her talk yet. And I've always said, you know, I said with the Bloomberg thing, you know, just wait till everybody hears him talk. This is going to end really, really fast. We'll see when she gets to the DNC. I think you wait about 2 weeks after the DNC, we'll know where this race is. I think there's a danger where he just thinks he's going to run back against Hillary, who, we're talking about Trump fatigue. There was Clinton fatigue that hurt Hillary. It wasn't just the woman thing, although I'm sure there was some people that just weren't going to vote for a woman no matter what. I'm sure there was a little bit of that. Really, it was she's not very popular, and people had seen her on TV for 15 years straight. That's what really hurt Hillary. And Trump was like, well, what the hell? Let's try this new thing. Trump's actually in the Hillary spot, but he's going to think that Harris is in the Hillary spot in this. I think there's a real danger that he gets in his mind stuck that this is 2016, and he tries to come off too hard and heavy, and it could hurt him, and he could blow this election that he should be winning right now.
Yeah, and he's already doing it. I mean, that was that whole thing with the National Association of Black Journalists when he did that whole not knowing or that Kamala was black. I mean, he's coming in already kind of hot and heavy, and you know, he just needs a few more of those type of situations where he's that I just don't think are going to work this time. And we'll come back to haunt him.
If he tries to do the stalking the stage, I talked to somebody about this and they were like, if you try to do the stalk around the stage thing he did to Hillary, which was super effective, that was one of the most effective optics of that entire election. A lot of people didn't like it, but it worked, you know, mm-hmm. where he just basically followed her around during that town hall. That was the one where she said, I'd put you in jail and all that. But Hillary's really unpopular, so you get away with that. If he tries to do that, and he's not the same candidate and he doesn't have the same energy now, if he tries to do that with Harris, and I don't know what the formats are, I'm really curious how these debates play out, because I don't know how he's going to respond to Kamala Harris. And I don't know how the general populace, not the diehards, not the base, how they're going to respond to how he attacks her. I think it's going to hit really differently.
Yeah. And I think the other thing you need to watch out is how will Kamala respond? Because I think going back to 2016, I don't think Hillary responded well to Trump. And the way that she responded was kind of in this, I'm better than you, I can, you know, I'm smarter than you kind of attitude. I think Kamala is different. She will not take any kind of gruff, and she will respond. I mean, I remember the vice presidential debate with Mike Pence. There's that kind of certain attitude that she can kind of muster up that she tries to kind of put someone in their place, that I think that, you know, if Trump is not careful, she will do that. And that will be the memorable moment. That will be the you should be in jail moment of those debates if they happen.
Folks, if you've listened to the Herd Tell program, you've heard our friend Gabriella Hoffman, but you need to make sure you're checking out her podcast, District of Conservation. It's a podcast exploring the nuances of true conservation efforts from D.C. and beyond. From topic discussions to exclusive interviews with conservation and energy newsmakers, Gabriella keeps listeners appraised of the latest news stories while elevating important voices. Listen to District of Conservation on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are played.
Religion is at the intersection of our 21st century life, even if we don't express a faith. At a time when it seems that religion isn't as prevalent as it once was, it still leaves its mark everywhere. As a pastor, I know that religion isn't something I just do on a Sunday, but it's found in every nook and cranny of my life. Sexuality, politics, social media, the economy, war, nationalism, all have some kind of religious angle to them. And as a communicator, I want to find the stories that can help people understand this part of our society that is so important to so many. Hi, I'm Dennis Sanders, and I'm the host of Church in Maine. Church in Maine is a podcast about the journey of faith and where it intersects with modern life. I look at faith with a journalist's eye, asking the who, where, what, why, and how religion affects some of the major issues of the day. Join me as we journey together. You can listen to Church in Maine podcasts at the website churchinmaine.org or on your favorite podcast app. I look forward to seeing you.
Dennis Saunders, let's talk real quick about Tim Walz. He is your governor. There's been mm-hmm. some talk about, let me preface this a little bit with, I think the VP selection can help. I think it can just not hurt. I don't think it makes a lick of electoral difference whatsoever as far as the actual votes of the VP. However, there's been talk about Tim Walz. He's your governor. Mm-hmm. You live there. There's been two points from his governorship that have really kind of gotten some traction among the Trump base and that the Walz and Harris campaign have pushed back against. So I want to ask him about both of you because you were involved in both of them. Let's start with the George Floyd stuff. And for people that don't know, you can go back and listen. We talked about this when it happened. You walked those streets. You pastored in those communities. You were down there where the violence and the burning and all that happened. You're there. That's your community. I don't remember when we had that. I don't think we mentioned Tim Walz one time on the two or three different podcasts we did and on the various. I don't think we ever mentioned him one time at the time. I don't remember him being on any of the national coverage. I remember talking about the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul. I remember talking about the prosecutors, various officials, some of the Congress people that were involved. I don't remember even talking about Tim Walz. Is that revisionist history, or was his performance during the George Floyd situation and the ensuing riots and all of that whole thing taken together? Now people want to kind of hang that on him. I don't remember talking about him at all during the time. You were actually there. What was his performance thought of at the time? What is it thought of now? Just kind of clarify that as somebody that was on the ground at that time and still there now.
You know, it was kind of interesting because you didn't really, going back to that time, hear about him that much. I mean, he did make, you know, some statements, so it wasn't that he wasn't there. But you didn't, you heard, as I think you're correct in saying, you heard more from Jacob Fry, the mayor, from, you know, kind of the attorney general, Keith Ellison, and some other people. But he wasn't as prominent. And I don't know if that was on purpose or what happened there, but you just didn't hear about him as much. I think some of the criticism about him, you know, you could say and that he may have dallied a bit in sending out the National Guard. But I also think this was a situation that was rather challenging. I mean, I think having those type of things like a riot or disturbances like that are not easy for any type of political leader to handle. I mean, you can't just come in guns blazing and trying to restore order. It's just hard. And so, and I think that that's going to be the case no matter what party the leader is in. This is just a hard situation. So it's, I think that there can be some things on how he handled it and whether he handled the crisis well. But I also think, one, I don't think it's going to land as well because of the difficulty of the situation. But two, some of the people who are making those accusations are people who may not either rarely go into cities or you know, are interested in cities anyway. So it's hard to say that you are upset about the situation when you don't have really any kind of buy-in at all anyway. So I think it's a problem, and I think he has to answer it well, but I also don't think it's something that will sink him either.
The other one is the COVID response. Every governor, every mayor, everybody had to deal with. Look, COVID is one of the few things we've seen in all human history where the entire planet was dealing with it at the same time. Some people dealt with it well. Some people didn't deal with it well. Changing information, all that, all the disclaimers on that. You were there. You were on the ground. What do you make now of the criticism of Tim Walz's? Because it seems like with the COVID stuff and with the George Floyd and the riot stuff, the Black Lives Matter riot, although it wasn't just that organization, it was other people involved. It seems like we're just taking talking points and applying it to him because that stuff all tracks really good virally, you know, in the right-wing cinematic universe. How much of it's fair? How much of it's not fair? What do you think of Tim Walz's governor's performance during COVID?
You know, I think early on, I wasn't that bothered by it. I thought he did the best that he could. It's funny, everyone is now talking about the quote-unquote snitch line that was out there. And the funny thing is, I don't remember that at all. I'm not saying that it didn't happen. I just don't remember it. So it's just kind of interesting. And I think, again, there are things that could be handled better. I think there were a lot of officials that, you know, kept schools closed probably too long. But this was also something, again, that was a once in a century event. I think some people kind of maybe went overboard. Some people hit it just right. But I think it's hard to try to figure out how to handle such a situation of a virus that you don't know how it's going to respond and how it's going to act. And so I think for the most part, he did the best that one could in the situation. But it is interesting because now I've heard some things about problems with nursing homes in that was similar to New York, which I never really heard that before. Could nursing homes have been handled better? Probably. But I didn't hear anything back then that was similar to how Cuomo handled New York and nursing homes. So some of that I do think is kind of borrowing things that we've heard before and then trying to put it into walls and say, oh, well, it's just like this. But I don't think that I haven't heard of some of those things before. So it's always, that's not to say that I think people are lying, but it's just interesting that we're bringing up stuff that maybe have been barely mentioned a few years earlier.
Yeah, Dennis Sanders joining us. The other thing that's come out with him is his military service. I've got my own thoughts on it. I've done a lot of research on my own through various channels to find out what's fair criticism and what's not. Fair is a bad word. Chief Conley always told me, he said, that's where you go to ride the rise and what you give the bus driver to go places. I'm not interested in fair. I'm not in the fair business. However, just electorally, when he ran for office, he came from a rural district that a Democrat doesn't always win in. Mm-hmm. So we have that background. Minnesota's statewide is pretty solidly Democratic, but it's not like, you know, it's not a deep blue state. It's competitive. It's usually within, 3 to 5 points, something like that. So he has a track record of running as a moderate and then governs a little more progressively than what he runs as. I think that's a fair way to put it, both his congressional record and his record as governor. Do you remember him running on his military service? Do you remember him talking about it a lot? Because right now the clips are all like, well, this is the only thing he ever talked about in the last 10 years. I know that's not the case. How is it playing there in Minnesota, though, that criticism? Do you remember him bringing it up a lot? Was it a key part of what he was running as? And you may have to get into a little bit because the Democratic Party in Minnesota is a little bit different with the DLF and all that. Do you remember it being an issue, and how is this current criticism playing there in Minnesota?
Yeah, I haven't noticed as much to see how much it is playing right now, but I do remember when he ran for governor in 2018, I didn't hear much about his military record. And, when he ran for Congress in 2016, in 2006, what I heard more about was the fact of him being a teacher. And in fact, that's what I heard again when he ran for governor. That's what I heard that came up front, was it was not anything about his service record, except that he served, that he was, in the military. But I didn't hear anything more than that. And I haven't followed the whole thing as deeply as other people have, but it seems like a lot of it is more semantics than anything else. It's not like it's not as people have gone as far as saying stolen valor. I don't think it is. But as I said before, when he ran both for the House and then later for governor, his talk about his military service was never the central focus of his campaign. In fact, the central focus that I would usually hear is about his role as a teacher.
Yeah, semantics is a word. There's military nomenclature that hits military people and veterans differently than it hits the general public. So when you're talking about, the process, the retirement process is not simple. That takes a while. So arguing over the semantics of, well, when did you know? Why did you retire? Whatever. I don't think this rise is a stolen value. I have found there's places where he's exaggerated a little bit. There's a way to talk about things where you say, I deployed, where it hints at more than what you did without you saying it. And there's a language to military service. It's its own language. So people pick up on things like that. So there's some exaggeration. Yeah. I found most of what he has said, like somebody else said something and then he didn't correct them. Well, if you're at a podium or you're on a dais or you're being introduced or something, should you correct it? Probably. Is that like, correcting your when you're a guest in somebody's house, and well, that's not the time to bring that up. I can see that one going both ways. The retirement thing, I'm having a hard time cracking a guy after 24 years when he had already planned for about a year and a half. When this, did he know about the deployment? Probably. In the job he had, he probably knew it was coming. He probably didn't know exactly when it was coming. He had clearly planned on getting out. So I, that one doesn't bother me all that much. And that's coming from somebody who I deployed in 05, I deployed in 07 to Iraq, and my enlistment was up in 06, and I reenlisted a lot because I just couldn't live with it. I'm like, all right, everybody's going in 07. I'm not stepping off in August of 06. We're going. But that was me. That was my personal decision. So just that's my background on that one. The retirement thing doesn't bother me that much. Some of the stuff he said, they're conflating because he did go to Afghanistan as a member of Congress on fact-finding stuff. So some of these clips you got to parse through. So my thing is, if you want to judge on the exaggeration and the embellishment, I think there's a there, but I don't think it's a hanging offense for somebody that did 24 years. That's just how it hits me. Now, other people have taken much more offense to it, and that's fine. I understand where they're coming from. On principle, I don't disagree on them. But then I've got Trump and Vance, who was pumping up Majewski in Ohio, who was lying about everything.
Yeah.
The dude was throwing bags and got busted down to E2 when he got put out for misbehavior. Like, I think politicizing veteran stuff on the front of it, unless it's something really egregious, is something that I'm starting to find really icky as a veteran. And I think the folks on the right who are really attacking him on this are overreaching a little bit. And I don't think it's going to work because the general public doesn't understand this nomenclature. And it's just going to, I think it's going to fall a little flat. I think there's a legit criticism there. I don't think it's a hanging offense. That's how it landed with me.
Yeah. I mean, that's how it's kind of landing with me as well, because it feels like a lot of this is kind of talking about different nomenclature. And again, I'm not as familiar, obviously, since I've never been in the military, but it feels to me like this is stuff that's more kind of centered on military terms. And so it's not as clear cut as you were talking about with Majewski in Ohio, where it's pretty clear that was a stolen valor thing. But this is not clear. And it seems like it's more parsing on little things than it is. And I think they're trying to build it up to be this stolen valor thing, but it's not. I don't think it's going to be a big it's not going to factor in the way that people think it will be.
No, I don't think it's changing any votes. Having said all that, as a constituency, fair and unfair, what is some fair and unfair criticism of Tim Walz that you've seen? We've covered some of the unfair ones already, though. What's some fair criticisms of his governorship that would apply? Because look, if vice president may not vote, but they are a heartbeat away from the presidency, God forbid anything happens to Kamala Harris if she's president, he would be president. So he has executive experience as a governor, which traditionally is something that you can, you know, scale up to the presidency. What's some legitimate criticisms or things that you would like to see him change or clean up if he was president, or you would be worried about if he became president?
Well, I think one of the fair criticisms is I think one of the reasons he was picked is because I think he codes as moderate. And, you know, his kind of everyman persona that he has, which I think is actually real. I don't think that's a put on or anything. It is real. But, you know, he is far more progressive than people might assume. And the question to me is, how does he talk about that? And how does he reach out to people who may not necessarily vote for Democrats, and to try to reach out and hopefully expand the vote? I don't know. Sometimes the way that he talks, like I said, he codes one way, but then when he is at the rallies and everything, it comes out much more progressive, and it obviously excites that base. Is it going to excite of someone in Toma, Wisconsin? I don't know. I think the criticism is, how does he talk to those people, and how does he talk in a way that he listens to them and understands them? It doesn't necessarily mean he has to agree with them, but how does he engage those voters? How does he engage the person in Warren, Michigan, who, the original kind of Reagan Democrats, they voted mostly for Trump in the last few years. How do you engage those people? Because it's one thing to kind of look the part, but it is also then, how do you kind of be that person that can stand up for the everyman?
What you're really talking about, Dennis Saunders joining us, is something that my progressive friends have been looking for the better part, but since Reagan, frankly. Mm-hmm. They're looking for that plain-spoken, everyman, rural unicorn that's going to Trojan horse the progressive ideas into the mainstream. They've been looking for that since Reagan. They're open about this. I don't blame them. That's what they've been wanting. And I have told them, I was like, well, you need to do what the populist right does. You got to tell it in all shucks, not in revolutionary fist up stuff.
Yeah.
That's how you do it.
And that's what Walls is.
I don't know if Walls is going to be that, but I think progressive folks are going to talk themselves into that's what he is. Is that a fair way to lay it out?
I think so. I think he is kind of that. But
by the way, I mean politically, I don't mean he's faking it, because I don't think he's faking it. I'm just saying they're going to project that onto him. And yeah. I think that's where that's kind of going to go.
I think in some ways what they're looking for is the reincarnation of Harry S. Truman. But the question is, will that really work? I don't know. It could. I think he, again, because of his background, because he is, he didn't go to Yale or kind of the East Coast universities. He was a teacher. As far as we know, he and his wife never really owned like stocks or anything in the way that a lot of congressmen and senators did or do. That might work. I think, again, the key is, will his kind of progressive policies, can he talk about those in a language of the common man and not in a condescending tone? That's going to be the question, is can he do that? Again, I don't know. I think that might work, but I'm not certain, because I think the problem with progressives is that they are good at kind of what they believe, but then the way that they present it is in a way that talks down to other people and puts people off. And they have to learn of how do they talk about these progressive issues in a way that is appealing to especially working class folk. And I don't think they've done a great job of doing that.
See, there's that union household upbringing creeping back in, because that's exactly, union membership's down under 10% in this country. Yep. And that's exactly where it went. A lot of that sort of stuff. Dennis Saunders. Okay. One more thing on this and we'll let you go though. But the obvious counterpoint to Tim Walz is going to be J.D. Vance. I'm not going to waste everybody's time on my J.D. Vance hot take, because that's well documented at this point. However, I'm very much looking forward to this debate, because it is a contrast of styles. It's a contrast. You just mentioned it. Walls is not only one of we talked about the military stuff. He'd be the first NCO. All other military members of high office have been officers. Mm-hmm. Some of them started as NCOs and bumped up, but he'd be the real honest non-officer ever. He's the first one since Jimmy Carter that's not have a background in the law. Lawyers have taken over everything. So that's a very interesting piece of this too. J.D. Vance is, look, he came from Middletown, Ohio, which is an hour north of Cincinnati and nowhere near Appalachia. Sorry, I got to get the one in. He is one of those law guys. He went and got that Ivy League law degree that he never practiced with, but used it to go be a venture capitalist and write his putrid book and so on and so forth. This is going to be a contrast of styles. We already talked about it a little bit with Harrison Trump. I think Walsh just has to laugh and all shucks it and let J.D. Vance be J.D. Vance, and he's probably going to win it regardless. If he brought out a policy about, you know, a purple elephant in every pot, he'd probably still win it on style points. But Walsh is going to have to control himself. Do you see things in his background with dealing, coming from that rural area that's a little bit more purple, reddish leaning, that he managed to win a couple congressional terms from, his time as a governor, the things you've seen in the campaign trail? What Walsh are we going to see in the debate against J.D. Vance, who he obviously doesn't like very much? J.D. Vance isn't going to like him at all. It's going to be a contrasting styles from two guys that have on paper similar backgrounds but took two very different career paths. And now they meet again. I like those kind of story arcs because I mean, if you're writing a movie, that's how you get a, you know, protagonist, antagonist. That's a classic story, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to meet. What are we going to see, and what in Walsh's background do you think you'll see from him?
Vance is, I mean, not Vance, but Walsh is going to really lean heavy into his common man, aw shucks background, but with an aggressive tone. Basically, he'll meet Vance's aggressive tone for tone. And I know we have some somewhat different views on Vance. Not that I necessarily like him, but I think sometimes he has some important things to say. But I also think he's been very, very careless in how he's talked about things over the years that is coming back to haunt him. Which is the case when you decide to be an edgelord. Somehow that's going to bite you at some point. And I think what Walsh is going to do is bring that up. I mean, he's going to do it in a kind of all shucks way, but he will bring the knife to Vance. And I think what he is going to do is highlight the differences. He will highlight the fact that, of course, he does have a common man background, and that Vance went to Yale, that Vance was a venture capitalist, whereas he was a teacher. So it's going to be a very aggressive, if that debate happens, it's going to be a very aggressive debate. And I think, personally, I think Walsh will probably be the one that can come out on top. Vance has, I think, a lot of talent, but I think it's still very raw. It's still very early. And I think, you know, he probably could have been a good vice presidential candidate 4 or 8 years from now. Right now, he's too raw, and I think he's not ready. And he still has a whole lot of growing up to do. And I think it's that debate is going to be one where I think the advantage will go to Walsh. And like I said, it's going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight. But the advantage will be that Walsh can use his everyman. I don't want to say stick because it's not a stick, but his persona to that advantage. Though I would say, please do stay away from any couch jokes, because that's just kind of... Yeah, I think that was very incredibly cringy when he did that in Philadelphia. So just don't do that anymore.
I think that was a flare just to let people know that he's aware of it. Mm-hmm. I hope he stays away from that. But I think the one thing about it, look, my bias against J.D. Vance, I'm upfront about it. So you were gentle in saying that we disagree on him. the man was drowning. I'd throw him a center block, but nah, I'm kidding. I don't want him dead, but.
Just injured.
Walsh can do charming. Vance, every time Vance tries to do charming, it comes off weird. I hate to see, I did it again. I don't want to use that term. He has that edgelord tech bro thing.
Yep.
Where the harder he tries to be, Trump does this too, but Trump is such a personality, he gets away with it. The thing with Vance is he's got that tech lord oligarch thing where the more he tries to be charming, the worse it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yep. he can be himself, and he does have personality and charisma, and he's very, very smart. There, mm-hmm. You know, his brain is functionally smart. His decision making is bad, and his people skills are off, And it's because he's boxed himself in with all the MAGA stuff. He doesn't know how to get back out of it because his background is not in that. It was, he came up against Trump. He came up speaking out against populism. So now he's boxed himself in. The more charming he tries to be forcefully, it comes off forced and doesn't seem. Waltz can do charming naturally. I think that's the difference. Now, that doesn't mean Vance can't wipe the floor with him on certain points, because I think Vance is really smart. And Waltz, you know, he's not been on this national stage. We're going to have to see how it plays. But that's just kind of how I feel about it. I think there's a trap here for J.D. Vance. And I'm not sure J.D. Vance has looked in the mirror and been honest with himself about what he's walking himself into.
No, he has not. I think it's going to be... I think that's why I say is I think it's going to be the advantage to Walls, because I think Walls, one, I think knows who he is, what he's about. Vance is still trying to figure that out. And in some ways, that's not surprising, but he has, in some ways, he's carrying all of the baggage that Trump and MAGA brings. And the thing is that as much as there are concerns about Walls and his record, and maybe all the kind of weird, the foolishness or things with on the left, it doesn't pale in, it pales in comparison to all of the stuff on Trump and MAGA. And he's just not going to be able to try to kind of brush that off. And I think Walls will hit him hard with that. And he just won't be able to run away from it.
Yeah. Dennis Saunders, I love these conversations. Time flies by
when we're
talking, because you're just so in-depth with stuff. You've got so much in that big brain of yours. You got multiple podcasts. You got Substacks. You've got writing going on. You got a lot going on. You hear some of it advertised right here on Hurtel. We're happy to do that for you. Let folks know where they can keep up with you and follow you until we get you back on again, which is going to be soon, because I love talking to you, my friend.
Okay. Well, people can follow my podcast, which is called Church in Maine. And this is a podcast where I kind of do the intersections of faith, politics, and culture. And you can follow along by going to churchinmaine, all one word, .org. And then you can also follow along on my Substack on Church in Maine, where I write articles that are kind of related to that issue. And it's churchinmaine.substack.com. And I'm on Twitter, and you can follow me at Denmin, or D-E-N-M-I-N-N.
That's Dennis in Minnesota, for those of you from Logan that didn't catch the abbreviation. we love Logan. I'm just kidding. That's a long-running joke between my dad and his best friend for years and years. So we love you, Logan, but we're going to always make fun of you because we kid those that we love. Dennis Saunders, we're going to do this again soon. We're going to get into this Christian nationalism mess, which is bad and deadly for the church at some point. You do good work, sir. Appreciate you. Thank you for the time.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back. See you soon. Sir.
Thank you.
All the music on Her Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.